Enzi advanced on me slowly, putting aside the folds of his cloak so that the hilt of his sword was freed to his hand. I hadn't heard the door behind me open. It must have stood ajar. How long had he been on the other side, listening?
"You," he said softly. "I should have known it. From the first I saw ye, I should have known."
His eyes were fixed on me, something between horror and fury in the cloudy green depths. There was a sudden stir in the air beside me. Jamie was there, a hand on my arm, urging me back behind him.
"Dougal," he said, "isn't it what you think, man? It's..."
"No,"
Dougal cut in. His gaze left me for a second, and I shrank behind Jamie, grateful for the respite.
"Not what I think," he said, still speaking softly. "I hear the woman urging you to foul murder, to the murder of your prince. Not only vile murder, but treason as well. And ye tell me I haven't heard it."
He shook his head, the tangled russet curls lank and greasy on his shoulders. Like the rest of us, he was starving. The bones jutted in his face, but his eyes burned from their shadowy orbits.
"I dinna blame ye, lad," he said.
His voice was suddenly weary, and I remembered that he was a man in his 50s.
"It isna your fault, Jamie. She's bewitched ye. Anyone can see that."
His mouth twisted as he looked again at me.
"Aye, I ken well enough how it's been for ye. She's worked the same sorcery on me betimes."
His eyes raked over me, burning.
"A murdering, lying slut would take a man by the cock and lead him to his doom with her claws sunk deep in his balls. That's the spell that they lay on you, lad. She and the other witch. Take you to their beds and steal the soul from you as you lie sleeping with your head on their breasts. They take your soul and eat your manhood, Jamie."
His tongue darted out and wetted his lips. He was still staring at me, and his hand tightened on the hilt of his sword.
"Stand aside, laddie. I'll free you of the Sassana whore."
Jamie stepped in front of me, momentarily blocking Dougal from my view.
"You're tired, Dougal," he said, speaking calmly, soothingly. "Tired and hearing things, man. Do you go down now? I shall..."
He had no chance to finish. Dougal wasn't listening to him. The deep-set green eyes were fixed on my face, and the Mackenzie chief had drawn the dirk from its sheath at his waist.
"I shall cut your throat," he said to me softly. "I should have done it when I first saw you. It would have saved us all a great grief."
I wasn't sure that he wasn't right, but that didn't mean I intended to let him remedy the matter. I took 3 quick steps back and fetched up hard against the table.
"Get back, man."
Jamie thrust himself before me, holding up a shielding forearm as Dougal advanced on me. The Mackenzie chieftain shook his head, bull-like, red-rimmed eyes fixed on me.
"She's mine," he said hoarsely. "Witch! Traitress! Step aside, lad, I wouldna harm you, but by God, if you shield that woman, I shall kill you too, foster son or no."
He lunged past Jamie, grabbing my arm. Exhausted, starving, and aging as he was still a formidable man, and his fingers bit deep into my flesh. I yelped with pain and kicked frantically at him as he jerked me toward him. He snatched at my hair and caught it, forcing my head back. His breath was hot and sour on my face. I shrieked and struck at him, digging my nails into his cheek in an effort to get free. The air exploded from his lungs as Jamie's fist struck him in the ribs, and his grip on my hair tore loose as Jamie's other fist came down in a numbing blow on the point of his shoulder. Suddenly freed, I fell back against the table, whimpering with shock and pain. Dougal whirled to face Jamie then, dropping into a fighter's crouch, the dirk held, blade upward.
"Let it be then,"
he said, breathing heavily. He swayed slightly from side to side, shifting his weight as he sought the advantage.
"Blood will tell, you damned Fraser spawn. Treachery runs in your blood. Come here to me, fox cub. I'll kill you quick for your mother's sake."
There was little room for manoeuvre in the small attic. No room to draw a sword. With his dirk stuck fast in the tabletop, Jamie was effectively unarmed. He matched Dougal's stance, eyes watchful, fixed on the point of the menacing dirk.
"Put it down, Dougal," he said. "If you bear my mother in mind, then listen to me for her sake."
The Mackenzie made no answer, but jabbed suddenly, a ripping blow aimed upward. Jamie dodged aside, dodged again the wide-arm sweep that came from the other side. Jamie had the agility of youth on his side, but Dougal held the knife. Dougal closed with a rush and the dirk slid up Jamie's side, ripping his shirt, scoring a dark line in his flesh. With a hiss of pain he jerked back, grabbing for Dougal's wrist, catching it as the blade struck down. The dull gleam of the blade flashed once, disappeared between the struggling bodies. They strove together, locked like lovers, the air filled with the smell of male sweat and fury. The blade rose again, two hands grappling on its rounded hilt. A shift and a jerk, a sudden grunt of effort, one of pain. Dougal stepped back, staggering, face congested and pouring sweat, the hilt of the dagger socketed at the base of his throat. Jamie half fell, gasping, and leaned against the table. His eyes were dark with shock, and his hair sweat-soaked, the rent edges of his shirt tinged with blood from the scratch. There was a terrible sound from Dougal, a sound of shock and stifled breath. Jamie caught him as he tottered and fell, Dougal's weight bringing him to his knees. Dougal's head lay on Jamie's shoulder, Jamie's arms locked around his foster father. I dropped to my knees beside them, reaching to help, trying to get hold of Dougal. It was too late. The big body went limp, then spasmed, sliding out of Jamie's grasp. Dougal lay crumpled on the floor, muscles jerking with involuntary contractions, struggling like a fish out of water. His head was pillowed on Jamie's thigh. One heave brought his face into view. It was contorted and dark red, eyes gone to slits. His mouth moved continuously, saying something, talking with great force, but without sound, save the bubbling rasp from his ruined throat. Jamie's face was ashen. Apparently he could tell what Dougal was saying. He struggled violently, trying to hold the thrashing body still. There was a final spasm, then a dreadful rattling sound, and Dougal Mackenzie lay still. Jamie's hands clenched tight upon his shoulders, as though to prevent his rising again.
"Blessed Michael, defend us!"
The hoarse whisper came from the doorway. It was Willie Coulter Mackenzie, one of Dougal's men. He stared in stupefied horror at the body of his chief. A small puddle of urine was forming under it, creeping out from under the sprawled plaid. The man crossed himself, still staring.
"Willie?"
Jamie rose, passing a trembling hand across his face.
"Willie!"
The man seemed struck dumb. He looked at Jamie in complete bewilderment, mouth open.
"I need 1 hour, man."
Jamie had a hand on Willie Coulter's shoulder, easing him into the room.
"An hour to see my wife safe. Then I shall come back to answer for this. I give you my word. On my honour. But I must have an hour free. 1 hour. Will you give me 1 hour, man, before you speak?"
Willie licked dry lips, looking back and forth between the body of his chief and his chieftain's nephew, clearly frightened out of his wits. At last he nodded, plainly having no idea what to do, choosing to follow this request because no reasonable alternative presented itself.
"Good."
Jamie swallowed heavily and wiped his face on his plaid. He patted Willie on the shoulder.
"Stay here, man. Pray for his soul."
He nodded toward the still form on the floor, not looking at it.
"And for mine."
He leaned past Willie to pry his dirk from the table, then pushed me before him, out the door, and down the stairs. Halfway down he stopped, leaning against the wall with his eyes closed. He drew deep, ragged breaths, as though he were about to faint. and I put my hands on his chest, alarmed. His heart was beating like a drum, and he was trembling. But after a moment, he drew himself upright, nodded at me, and took my arm.
"I need Myrtle," he said.
We found the clansman just outside, cowled in his plaid against the sleety rain, sitting in a dry spot beneath the eaves of the house. Fergus was curled up next to him, dozing, tired from the long ride. Myrtle took one look at Jamie's face and rose to his feet, dark and dour, ready for anything.
"I've killed Dougal Mackenzie," Jamie said bluntly, without preliminary.
Murtaugh's face went quite blank for a moment, then his normal expression of wary grimness reasserted itself.
"Aye," he said. "What's to do, then?"
Jamie groped in his sporran and brought out a folded paper. His hand shook as he tried to unfold it, and I took it from him, spreading it out under the shelter of the eaves. "Deed of Sasin," it said, at the top of the sheet. It was a short document, laid out in a few black lines, conveying title of the estate known as Broch Turach to one James Jacob Fraser Murray, said property to be held in trust and administered by the said James Murray's parents, Janet Fraser Murray and Ian Gordon Murray, until the said James Murray's majority. Jamie's signature was at the bottom, and there were two blank spaces provided below, each with the word witness written alongside. It was dated 1st of July, 1745, a month before Charles Stuart had launched his rebellion on the shores of Scotland and made Jamie Fraser a traitor to the crown.
"I'll need you to sign this, you and Claire," Jamie said, taking the note from me and handing it to Myrtle. "But it means forswearing yourself. I have nae right to ask it."
Myrtle's small black eyes scanned the deed quickly.
"No," he said dryly. "No right. Nor any need either."
He nudged Fergus with a foot, and the boy sat bolt upright, blinking.
"Nip into the house and fetch your chief ink and a quill, lad," Myrtle said. "And quick about it. Go."
Fergus shook his head once to clear it, glanced at Jamie for a confirming nod, and went. Water was dripping from the eaves down the back of my neck. I shivered and drew the woolen arased closer around my shoulders. I wondered when Jamie had written the document. The false date made it seem the property had been transferred before Jamie became a traitor, with his goods and lands subject to seizure. If it wasn't questioned, the property would pass safely to small Jamie. Jenny's family, at least, would be safe, still in possession of land and farmhouse. Jamie had seen the possible need for this, yet he hadn't executed the document before we left Lallybroch. He had hoped somehow to return and claim his own place once again. Now that was impossible, but the estate might still be saved from seizure. There was no one to say when the document had really been signed, save the witnesses, me and Myrtle. Fergus returned, panting, with a small glass inkpot and a ragged quill. We signed one at a time, leaning against the side of the house, careful to shake the quill first to keep the ink from dripping down. Myrtle went first. His middle name, I saw, was Fitzgibbons.
"Will ye have me take it to your sister?"
Myrtle asked as I shook the paper carefully to dry it. Jamie shook his head. The rain made damp, coin-sized splotches on his plaid, and glittered on his lashes like tears.
"No. Fergus will take it."
"Me?" The boy's eyes went round with astonishment.
"You, man."
Jamie took the paper from me, folded it, then knelt and tucked it inside Fergus's shirt.
"This must reach my sister, Madam Murray, without fail. It is worth more than my life, man. Or yours."
Practically breathless with the enormity of the responsibility entrusted to him, Fergus stood up straight, hands clasped over his middle.
"I will not fail you, milor."
A faint smile crossed Jamie's lips, and he rested a hand briefly on the smooth cap of Fergus's hair.
"I know that man, and I am grateful," he said.
He twisted the ring off his left hand, the cabochon ruby that had belonged to his father.
"Here," he said,
handing it to Fergus.
"Go to the stables and show this to the old man you'll see there. Tell him I said you have to take Donas. Take the horse and ride for Lallybroch. Stop for nothing, except, as you must, to sleep. And when you do sleep, hide yourself well."
Fergus was speechless with alarmed excitement, but Murtagh frowned dubiously at him.
"Do you think the bairn can manage yon wicked beast?" he said.
"Aye, he can,"
Jamie said firmly. Overcome, Fergus stuttered, then sank to his knees and kissed Jamie's hand fervently. Springing to his feet, he darted away in the direction of the stables, his slight figure disappearing in the mist. Jamie licked dry lips and closed his eyes briefly, then turned to Murtagh with decision.
"And you, Mulcarraig, I need you to gather the men."
Murtagh's sketchy brow shot up, but he merely nodded.
"Aye," he said, "and when I have..."
Jamie glanced at me, then back at his godfather.
"He'll be on the moor now, I think, with young Simon. Just gather them together in one place. I shall see my wife safe, and then..."
He hesitated, then shrugged.
"I will find you. Wait my coming."
Murtagh nodded once more and turned to go. Then he paused and turned back to face Jamie. The thin mouth twitched briefly, and he said,
"I would ask the one thing of you, lad. Let it be the English, not your ain folk."
Jamie flinched slightly, but after a moment he nodded. Then, without speaking, he held out his arms to the older man. They embraced quickly, fiercely, and Murtagh too was gone in a swirl of ragged tartan. I was the last bit of business on the agenda.
"Come on, Sassenach,"
he said, seizing me by the arm.
"We must go."
No one stopped us. There was so much coming and going by the roads that we were scarcely noticed while we were near the moor. Farther away, when we left the main road, there was no one to see. Jamie was completely silent, concentrating single-mindedly on the job at hand. I said nothing to him, too occupied with my own shock and dread to wish for conversation.
"I shall see my wife safe."
I hadn't known what he meant by that, but it became obvious within 2 hours when he turned the head of his horse farther south and the steep green hill called Craig na Dun came in view. "No," I said when I saw it and realized where we were headed. "Jamie, no, I won't go." He didn't answer me, only spurred his horse and galloped ahead, leaving me no option but to follow. My feelings were in turmoil. Beyond the doom of the coming battle and the horror of Dougal's death, now there was the prospect of the stones. That accursed circle through which I had come here. Plainly, Jamie meant to send me back. Back to my own time, if such a thing was possible.
He could mean all he liked, I thought, clenching my jaws. I followed him down the narrow trail through the heather. There was no power on earth that could make me leave him now.
We stood together on the hillside, in the small dooryard of the ruined cottage that stood below the crest of the hill. No one had lived there for years. The local folk said the hill was haunted, a fairy's done. Jamie had half-urged, half-dragged me up the slope, paying no attention to my protests. At the cottage, he had stopped, though, and sunk to the ground, chest heaving as he gasped for breath.
"That's all right," he said at last. "We have a bit of time now. No one will find us here."
He sat on the ground, his plaid wrapped around him for warmth. It had stopped raining for the moment, but the wind blew cold from the mountains nearby, where snow still capped the peaks and choked the passes. He let his head fall forward onto his knees, exhausted by the flight. I sat close by him, huddled within my cloak, and felt his breathing gradually slow as the panic subsided. We sat in silence for a long time, afraid to move from what seemed a precarious perch above the chaos below. Chaos I felt I had somehow helped create. Jamie, I said at last. I reached out a hand to touch him, but then drew back and let it fall. Jamie, I'm sorry. He continued to look out into the darkening void of the moor below. For a moment, I thought he hadn't heard me. He closed his eyes, then he shook his head very slightly.
No,
he said softly.
There is no need.
But there is. Grief nearly choked me, but I felt as though I must say it, must tell him that I knew what I had done to him.
I should have gone back.
Jamie, if I'd gone then, when you brought me here from Crane's Muir, maybe then...
Aye, maybe,
he interrupted. He swung toward me abruptly, and I could see his eyes fixed on me. There was longing there, and a grief that matched mine, but no anger, no reproach. He shook his head again.
No, he said once more. I ken what you mean, Modunya, but it isn't so. Had you gone then, matters might still have happened as they have. Maybe so, maybe no. Perhaps it would have come sooner. Perhaps differently. Perhaps, just perhaps, not at all. But there are more folk have had a hand in this than we two, and I will not have you take the guilt of it upon yourself.
His hand touched my hair, smoothing it out of my eyes. A tear rolled down my cheek, and he caught it on his finger. Not that, I said. I flung a hand out toward the dark, taking in the armies, and Charles, and the starved man in the wood, and the slaughter to come. Not that. What I did to you. He smiled then with great tenderness, and smoothed his palm across my cheek, warm on my spring-chilled skin.
Aye, and what have I done to you, Sassenach? Taken you from your own place, led you into poverty and outlawry, taken you through battlefields and risked your life? Do you hold it against me?
You know I don't. He smiled.
Aye, well, neither do I, Miss Asenach.
The smile faded from his face as he glanced up at the crest of the hill above us. The stones were invisible, but I could feel the menace of them close at hand. I won't go, Jamie, I repeated stubbornly. I'm staying with you.
No.
He shook his head. He spoke gently, but his voice was firm, with no possibility of denial.
I must go back, Claire.
Jamie, you can't. I clutched his arm urgently. Jamie, they'll have found Dougal by now. Willie Coulter will have told someone.
Aye, he will.
He put a hand over my arm and patted it. He had reached his decision on the ride to the hill. I could see it in his shadowed face. Resignation and determination mingled. There was grief there, and sadness too. But those had been put aside. He had no time for mourning now. We could try to get away to France, I said. Jamie, we must. But even as I spoke, I knew I couldn't turn him from the course he had decided on.
No,
he said again softly. He turned and lifted a hand, gesturing toward the darkening valley below, the shaded hills beyond.
The country is roused, Sassenach. The ports are closed. O'Brien has been trying for the last 3 months to bring a ship to rescue the prince, to take him to safety in France. Dougal told me before...
A tremor passed over his face, and a sudden spasm of grief knit his brows. He pushed it aside, though, and went on, explaining in a steady voice...
It's only the English who are hunting Charles Stuart. It'll be the English, and the clans as well, who hunt me. I'm a traitor twice over, a rebel and a murderer. Claire.
He paused, rubbing a hand across the back of his neck, then said gently,
Claire, I am a dead man.
The tears were freezing on my cheeks, leaving icy trails that burned my skin.
No!
I said again, but to no effect.
I'm no precisely inconspicuous, you can,
he said, trying to make a joke of it as he ran a hand through the rusty locks of his hair.
Red Jimmy wouldna get far, I think.
But you... He touched my mouth, tracing the line of my lips.
I can save you, Claire, and I will. That is the most important thing. But then I shall go back for my men.
The men from Lallybroch? But how?
Jamie frowned, absently fingering the hilt of his sword as he thought.
I think I can get them away. It'll be confused on the moor, we men and horses moving to and fro, and orders shouted and contradicted. Battles are very messy affairs. And even if it's known by then what I've done, he continued, with a momentary catch in his voice, there are none who would stop me then, with the English in sight and the battle about to begin. Aye, I can do it, he said.
His voice had steadied, and his fists clenched at his sides with determination.
They will follow me without question, God help them. That's what brought them here. Murtaugh will have gathered them for me. I shall take them and lead them from the field. If anyone tries to stop me, I shall say that I claim the right to lead my own men in battle. Not even young Simon will deny me that.
He drew a deep breath, brows knit as he visualized the scene on the battlefield come morning.
I shall bring them safely away. The field is broad enough, and there are enough men that no one will realize that we have na but moved to a new position. I shall bring them off the moor, and see them set on the road toward Lallybroch.
He fell silent, as though this were as far as he had thought in his plans. And then? I asked, not wanting to know the answer, but unable to stop myself.
And then I shall turn back to Culloden, he said, letting out his breath.
He gave me an unsteady smile.
I'm no afraid to die, Sassenach.
His mouth quirked wryly.
Well, not a lot, anyway, but some of the ways of accomplishing the fact.
A brief, involuntary shudder ran through him, but he tried to keep smiling.
I doubt I should be thought worthy of the services of a true professional, but I expect in such a case both Monsieur Fauré and myself might find it awkward, I mean, having my heart cut out by someone I've shared wine with.
With a sound of incoherent distress, I flung my arms around him, holding him as tightly as I could.
"It's all right," he whispered into my hair. "It's all right, Sassenach. A musket ball. Maybe a blade. It'll be over quickly."
I knew this was a lie. I had seen enough of battle wounds and the deaths of warriors. All that was true was that it was better than waiting for the hangman's noose. The terror that had ridden with me from Sandringham's estate rose now to high tide, choking, drowning me. My ears rang with my own pulse beat and my throat closed so tight that I felt I couldn't breathe. Then, all at once, the fear left me. I could not leave him, and I would not.
"Jamie," I said, into the folds of his plaid, "I'm going back with you."
He started back, staring down at me.
"The hell you are," he said.
"I am."
I felt very calm, with no trace of doubt. "I can make a kilt of my Arisid. There are enough young boys with the army that I can pass for one.
You've said yourself it will all be confusion. No one will notice."
"No," he said. "No, Claire."
His jaw was clenched and he was glaring at me with a mixture of anger and horror.
"If you're not afraid, I'm not either," I said, firming my own jaw. "It will be over quickly. You said so."
My chin was beginning to quiver, despite my determination. "Jamie, I won't. I can't. I bloody won't live without you, and that's all." He opened his mouth, speechless, then closed it, shaking his head. The light over the mountains was failing, painting the clouds with a dull red glow. At last he reached for me, drew me close, and held me.
"Do you think I don't know?" he asked softly. "It's me that has the easy part now. For if you feel for me as I do for you, then I am asking you to tear out your heart and live without it."
His hand stroked my hair, the roughness of his knuckles catching in the blowing strands.
"But you must do it, Modunia. My brave lioness.
You must.
Why? I demanded, pulling back to look up at him. When you took me from the witch trial at Cranesmere, you said then that you would have died with me. You would have gone to the stake with me, had it come to that. He grasped my hands, fixing me with a steady blue gaze.
I would, he said. But I wasn't a-carrying your child.
The wind had frozen me. It was the cold that made me shake, I told myself. The cold that took my breath away. You can't tell, I said at last. It's much too soon to be sure. He snorted briefly, and a tiny flicker of amusement lit his eyes.
And me a farmer, too. Sassenach, you haven't been a day late in your courses in all the time since you first took me to your bed. You haven't bled now in 46 days.
You bastard, I said outraged. You counted. In the middle of a bloody war, you counted.
Didn't you?
No.
I hadn't. I'd been much too afraid to acknowledge the possibility of the thing I had hoped and prayed for so long, come now so horribly too late.
Besides, I went on, trying still to deny the possibility, that doesn't mean anything. Starvation could cause that. It often does.
He lifted one brow and cupped a broad hand gently beneath my breast.
Aye, you're thin enough, but scrawny as you are, your breasts are full, and the nipples of them gone the colour of champagne grapes. You forget, he said. I've seen you so before. I have no doubt, and neither have you.
I tried to fight down the waves of nausea, so easily attributable to fright and starvation, but I felt the small heaviness suddenly burning in my womb. I bit my lip hard, but the sickness washed over me. Jamie let go my hands and stood before me, hands at his side, stark in silhouette against the fading sky.
Claire, he said quietly, tomorrow I will die. This child is all that will be left of me, ever. I ask you, Claire, I beg you, see it safe.
I stood still, vision blurring, and in that moment I heard my heart break. It was a small, clean sound, like the snapping of a flower's stem. At last I bent my head to him, the wind grieving in my ears. Yes, I whispered, yes, I'll go. It was nearly dark. He came behind me and held me, leaning back against him as he looked over my shoulder out over the valley. The lights of watchfires had begun to spring up, small glowing dots in the far distance. We were silent for a long time as the evening deepened. It was very quiet on the hill. I could hear nothing but Jamie's even breathing, each breath a precious sound.
"I will find you," he whispered in my ear. "I promise. If I must endure 200 years of purgatory, 200 years without you, then that is my punishment, which I have earned for my crimes. For I have lied and killed and stolen, betrayed and broken trust. But there is the one thing that shall lie in the balance. When I shall stand before God, I shall have one thing to say to weigh against the rest."
His voice dropped nearly to a whisper, and his arms tightened around me.
"Lord, you gave me a rare woman, and God, I loved her well."
He was slow and careful. So was I. Each touch, each moment must be savoured, remembered, treasured as a talisman against a future empty of him. I touched each soft hollow, the hidden places of his body, felt the grace and the strength of each curving bone, the marvel of his firm-knit muscles, drawn lean and flexible across the span of his shoulders, smooth and solid down the length of his back, hard as seasoned oak wood in the columns of his thighs. Tasted the salty sweat in the hollow of his throat, smelled the warm muskiness of the hair between his legs, the sweetness of the soft, wide mouth, tasting faintly of dried apple and the bitter tang of juniper berries.
"You are so beautiful, my own,"
he whispered to me, touching the slipperiness between my legs, the tender skin of my inner thighs. His head was no more than a dark blur against the white blur of my breasts. The holes in the roof admitted only the faintest light from the overcast sky. The soft grumble of spring thunder muttered constantly in the hills beyond our fragile walls. He was hard in my hand, so stiff with the wanting, that my touch made him groan in a need close to pain. When he could wait no longer, he took me, a knife to its scabbard, and we moved hard together, pressing, wanting, needing so urgently that moment of ultimate joining, and fearing to reach it, for the knowledge that beyond it lay eternal separation. He brought me again and again to the peaks of sensation, holding back himself, stopping, gasping, and shuddering on the brink. Until at last I touched his face, twined my fingers in his hair, pressed him tight, and arched my back and hips beneath him, urging, forcing. "Now," I said to him softly, "now, come with me, come to me now, now." He yielded to me, and I to him, despair lending edge to passion, so the echo of our cries seemed to die away slowly, ringing in the darkness of the cold stone hut. We lay pressed together, unmoving, his weight a heavy blessing, a shield and reassurance. A body so solid, so filled with heat and life, how could it be possible that he would cease to exist within hours?
"Listen," he said at last, softly. "Do you hear?"
At first I heard nothing but the rushing of the wind and the trickle of rain dripping through the holes of the roof. Then I heard it, the steady, slow thump of his heartbeat, pulsing against me and mine against his, each matching each in the rhythm of life. The blood coursed through him and through our fragile link, through me and back again. We lay so, warm beneath the makeshift covering of plaid and cloak, on a bed of our clothing tangled together. Then at last he slipped free, and turning me away from him, cupped his hand across my belly, his breath warm on the nape of my neck.
"Sleep now a bit, Mudunya," he whispered. "I would sleep once more this way, holding you, holding the babe."
I had thought I couldn't sleep, but the pull of exhaustion was too much, and I slipped beneath the surface with scarcely a ripple. Near dawn I woke, Jamie's arms still around me, and lay watching the imperceptible bloom of night into day, futilely willing back the friendly shelter of the dark. I rolled to the side and lifted myself to watch him, to see the light touch the bold shape of his face, innocent in sleep, to see the dawning sun touch his hair with flame, for the last time. A wave of anguish broke through me, so acute that I must have made some sound, for he opened his eyes. He smiled when he saw me, and his eyes searched my face. I knew that he was memorizing my features as I was his.
"Jamie," I said.
My voice was hoarse with sleep and swallowed tears.
"Jamie, I want you to mark me."
"What?" he said, startled. The tiny skean-doo he carried in his stocking was lying within reach, its handle of carved staghorn dark against the piled clothing. I reached for it and handed it to him. "Cut me," I said urgently, "deep enough to leave a scar. I want to take away your touch with me, to have something of you that will stay with me always. I don't care if it hurts. Nothing could hurt more than leaving you. At least when I touch it, wherever I am, I can feel your touch on me." His hand was over mine where it rested on the knife's hilt. After a moment, he squeezed it and nodded. He hesitated for a moment, the razor-sharp blade in his hand, and I offered him my right hand. It was warm beneath our coverings, but his breath came in wisps, visible in the cold air of the room. He turned my palm upward, examining it carefully, then raised it to his lips. A soft kiss in the well of the palm. Then he seized the base of my thumb in a hard, sucking bite. Letting go, he swiftly cut into the numbed flesh. I felt no more than a mild burning sensation, but the blood welled at once. He brought the hand quickly to his mouth again, holding it there until the flow of blood slowed. He bound the wound, now stinging, carefully in a handkerchief, but not before I saw that the cut was in the shape of a small, slightly crooked letter J. I looked up to see that he was holding out the tiny knife to me. I took it and somewhat hesitantly took the hand he offered me. He closed his eyes briefly and set his lips, but a small grunt of pain escaped him as I pressed the tip of the knife into the fleshy pad at the base of his thumb. The mound of Venus, a palm reader had told me, indicator of passion and love. It was only as I completed the small semicircular cut that I realized he had given me his left hand. "I should have taken the other," I said. "Your sword hilt will press on it." He smiled faintly. "I could ask no more than to feel your touch on me in my last fight, wherever it comes." Unwrapping the blood-spotted handkerchief, I pressed my wounded hand tightly against his, fingers gripped together. The blood was warm and slick, not yet sticky, between our hands. "Blood of my blood," I whispered. "And boon of my boon," he answered softly. Neither of us could finish the vow, so long as we both shall live. But the unspoken words hung aching between us. Finally, he smiled crookedly.
"Longer than that," he said firmly,
and pulled me to him once more.
"Frank," he said at last, with a sigh. "Well, I'll leave it to you what you shall tell him about me. Likely he'll not want to hear. But if he does, if you find you can talk to him of me as you have to me of him, then tell him I'm grateful. Tell him I trust him because I must. And tell him."
His hands tightened suddenly on my arms, and he spoke with a mixture of laughter and absolute sincerity.
"Tell him I hate him to his guts and the marrow of his bones."
We were dressed, and the dawn light had strengthened into day. There was no food, nothing with which to break our fast. Nothing left that must be done, and nothing left to say. He would have to leave now to make it to Dromossi Moor in time. This was our final parting, and we could find no way to say goodbye. At last he smiled crookedly, bent, and kissed me gently on the lips.
"They say," he began, and stopped to clear his throat. "They say, in the old days, when a man would go forth to do a great deed, he would find a wise woman and ask her to bless him. He would stand, looking forth in the direction he would go, and she would come behind him to say the words of the prayer over him. When she had finished, he would walk straight out and not look back, for that was ill luck to his quest."
He touched my face once more, and turned away, facing the open door. The morning sun streamed in, lighting his hair in a thousand flames. He straightened his shoulders, broad beneath his plaid, and drew a deep breath.
"Bless me, then, wise woman," he said softly, "and go."
I laid a hand on his shoulder, groping for words. Jenny had taught me a few of the ancient Celtic prayers of protection. I tried to summon the words in my mind. "Jesus, thou son of Mary," I started, speaking hoarsely. "I call upon thy name, and on the name of John the Apostle beloved, and on the names of all the saints in the Red Domain, to shield thee in the battle to come." I stopped, interrupted by a sound from the hillside below. The sound of voices, and of footsteps. Jamie froze for a second, shoulder hard beneath my hand, then whirled, pushing me toward the rear of the cottage where the wall had fallen away.
"That way," he said. "They are English. Claire, go."
I ran toward the opening in the wall, heart in my throat, as he turned back to the doorway, hand on his sword. I stopped, just for a moment, for the last sight of him. He turned his head, caught sight of me, and suddenly he was with me, pushing me hard against the wall in an agony of desperation. He gripped me fiercely to him. I could feel his erection pressing into my stomach and the hilt of his dagger dug into my side. He spoke hoarsely into my hair.
"Once more, I must. But quick."
He pushed me against the wall and I scrabbled up my skirts as he raised his kilt. This wasn't lovemaking. He took me quickly and powerfully, and it was over in seconds. The voices were nearer, only 100 yards away. He kissed me once more, hard enough to leave the taste of blood in my mouth.
"Name him Brian," he said, "for my father."
With a push, he sent me toward the opening. As I ran for it, I glanced back to see him standing in the middle of the doorway, sword half-drawn, dirk ready in his right hand. The English, unaware that the cottage was occupied, hadn't thought to send a scout round the back. The slope behind the cottage was deserted as I dashed across it and into the thicket of alders below the hill crest. I pushed my way through the brush and the branches, stumbling over rocks, blinded by tears. Behind me I could hear shouts and the clash of steel from the cottage. My thighs were slick and wet with Jamie's seed. The crest of the hill seemed never to grow nearer. Surely I would spend the rest of my life fighting my way through the strangling trees. There was a crashing in the brush behind me. Someone had seen me rush from the cottage. I dashed aside the tears and scrabbled upward, groping on all fours as the ground grew steeper. I was in the clear space now, the shelf of granite I remembered. The small dogwood growing out of the cliff was there, and the tumble of small boulders. I stopped at the edge of the stone circle, looking down, trying desperately to see what was happening. How many soldiers had come to the cottage? Could Jamie break free of them and reach his hobbled horse below? Without it, he would never reach Culloden in time. All at once, the brush below me parted with a flash of red. An English soldier. I turned, ran gasping across the turf of the circle, and hurled myself through the cleft in the rock. Part 7. Hindsight. Chapter 47. Loose Ends. He was right, of course. Bloody man, he was almost always right. Claire sounded half cross as she spoke. A rueful smile crossed her face. Then she looked at Brianna, who sat on the hearthrug, gripping her knees, her face completely blank. Only the faint stir of her hair, lifting and moving in the rising heat of the fire, showed any motion at all. It was a dangerous pregnancy, again, and a hazardous birth. Had I risked it there, it would almost certainly have killed us both. She spoke directly to her daughter, as though they were alone in the room. Roger, waking slowly from the spell of the past, felt like an intruder. The truth, then, all of it. "I couldn't bear to leave him," Claire said softly. "Even for you." "I hated you for a bit before you were born, because it was for you that he'd made me go. I didn't mind dying, not with him. But to have to go on, to live without him..." He was right. I had the worst of the bargain. But I kept it because I loved him. And we lived, you and I, because he loved you. Brianna didn't move, didn't take her eyes from her mother's face. Only her lips moved, stiffly, as though unaccustomed to talking. "How long did you hate me?" Gold eyes met blue ones, innocent and ruthless as the eyes of a falcon. "Until you were born. When I held you and nursed you and saw you look up at me with your father's eyes. Brianna made a faint strangled sound, but her mother went on, voice softening a little as she looked at the girl at her feet. "And then I began to know you, something separate from myself or from Jamie. And I loved you for yourself, and not only for the man who fathered you." There was a blur of motion on the hearthrug, and Brianna shot erect. Her hair bristled out like a lion's mane, and the blue eyes blazed like the heart of the flames behind her. "Frank Randall was my father," she said. "He was. I know it." Fists clenched, she glared at her mother. Her voice trembled with rage. "I don't know why you're doing this. Maybe you did hate me. Maybe you still do." Tears were beginning to make their way down her cheeks unbidden, and she dashed them angrily away with the back of one hand. "Daddy. Daddy loved me. He couldn't have if I weren't his. Why are you trying to make me believe he wasn't my father? Were you jealous of me? Is that it? Did you mind so much that he loved me? He didn't love you, I know that." The blue eyes narrowed, cat-like, blazing in a face gone dead white. Roger felt a strong desire to ease behind the door before she noticed his presence and turned that molten wrath on him. But beyond his own discomfort, he was conscious of a sense of growing awe. The girl that stood on the hearthrug, hissing and spitting in defense of her paternity, flamed with a wild strength that had brought the Highland warriors down on their enemies like shrieking banshees. Her long, straight nose, lengthened still further by the shadows, eyes slitted like a snarling cat's, she was the image of her father. And her father was patently not the dark, quiet scholar whose photo adorned the jacket of the book on the table. Claire opened her mouth once, but then closed it again, watching her daughter with absorbed fascination. That powerful tension of the body, the flexing arch of the broad, flat cheekbones. Roger thought that she had seen that many times before, but not in Brianna. With a suddenness that made them both flinch, Brianna spun on her heel, grabbed the yellowed news clippings from the desk, and thrust them into the fire. She snatched the poker and jabbed it viciously into the tindery mass, heedless of the shower of sparks that flew from the hearth and hissed about her booted feet. Whirling from the rapidly blackening mass of glowing paper, she stamped one foot on the hearth. "Bitch!" she shouted at her mother. "You hated me. Well, I hate you." She drew back the arm with the poker, and Roger's muscles tensed instinctively, ready to lunge for her. But she turned, arm drawn back like a javelin thrower, and hurled the poker through the full-length window, where the panes of night-dark glass reflected the image of a burning woman for one last instant, before the crash and shiver into empty black. The silence in the study was shattering. Roger, who had leapt to his feet in pursuit of Brianna, was left standing in the middle of the room, awkwardly frozen. He looked down at his hands as if not quite sure what to do with them, then at Claire. She sat perfectly still in the sanctuary of the wing chair, like an animal frozen by the passing shadow of a raptor. After several moments, Roger moved across to the desk and leaned against it.
"I don't know what to say," he said.
Claire's mouth twitched faintly.
"Neither do I."
They sat in silence for several minutes. The old house creaked, settling around them, and a faint noise of banging pots came down the hallway from the kitchen, where Fiona was doing something about dinner. Roger's feelings of shock and constrained embarrassment gradually gave way to something else. He wasn't sure what. His hands felt icy, and he rubbed them on his legs, feeling the warm rasp of the corduroy on his palms. He started to speak, then stopped and shook his head. Claire drew a deep breath, and he realized that it was the first movement he had seen her make since Brianna had left. Her gaze was clear and direct. "Do you believe me?" she asked. Roger looked thoughtfully at her.
"I'll be damned if I know," he said at last.
That provoked a slightly wavering smile. "That's what Jamie said," she said, "when I asked him at the first where he thought I'd come from.
I can't see I blame him."
Roger hesitated, then, making up his mind, got off the desk and came across the room to her.
"May I?"
He knelt and took her unresisting hand in his, turning it to the light. "You can tell real ivory from the synthetic," he remembered suddenly, "because the real kind feels warm to the touch." The palm of her hand was a soft pink, but the faint line of the J at the base of her thumb was white as bone. "It doesn't prove anything," she said, watching his face. "It could have been an accident. I could have done it myself."
"But you didn't, did you?"
He laid the hand back in her lap very gently, as though it were a fragile artifact. "No, but I can't prove it." "The pearls," her hand went to the shimmer of the necklace at her throat, "they're authentic. That can be verified. But can I prove where I got them?" "No."
"And the portrait of Ellen Mackenzie,"
he began. "The same. A coincidence. Something to base my delusion upon. My lies." There was a faintly bitter note in her voice, though she spoke calmly enough. There was a patch of colour in each cheek now, and she was losing that utter stillness. It was like watching a statue come to life, he thought. Roger got to his feet. He paced slowly back and forth, rubbing a hand through his hair.
"But it's important to you, isn't it? It's very important."
"Yes." She rose herself and went to the desk where the folder of his research sat. She laid a hand on the manila sheeting with reverence, as though it were a gravestone. He supposed to her it was. "I had to know." There was a faint quaver in her voice, but he saw her chin firm instantly, suppressing it. "I had to know if he'd done it, if he'd saved his men, or if he'd sacrificed himself for nothing. And I had to tell Brianna. Even if she doesn't believe it, if she never believes it. Jamie was her father. I had to tell her."
"Yes, I see that. And you couldn't do it while Dr. Randall, your husband, I mean, Frank," he corrected himself, flushing, "was alive."
She smiled faintly.
"It's all right. You can call Frank my husband. He was, after all, for a good many years."
"And Bree's right, in a way. He was her father as well as Jamie." She glanced down at her hands and spread the fingers of both, so the light gleamed from the two rings she wore, silver and gold. Roger was struck by a thought.
"Your ring," he said, coming to stand close by her again. "The silver one. Is there a maker's mark on it? Some of the 18th century Scottish silversmiths used them. It might not be proof positive, but it's something."
Claire looked startled. Her left hand covered the right protectively, fingers rubbing the wide silver band with its pattern of Highland interlace and thistle blooms. "I don't know," she said. A faint blush rose in her cheeks. "I haven't seen inside it. I've never taken it off." She twisted the ring slowly over the joint of the knuckle. Her fingers were slender, but from long wearing the ring had left a groove in her flesh. She squinted at the inside of the ring, then rose and brought it to the table where she stood next to Roger, tilting the silver circle to catch the light from the table lamp. "There are words in it," she said wonderingly. "I never realized that he'd..." "Oh, dear God!" Her voice broke, and the ring slipped from her fingers, rattling on the table with a tiny metal chime. Roger hurriedly scooped it up, but she had turned away, fists held tight against her middle. He knew she didn't want him to see her face. The control she had kept through the long hours of the day and the scene with Brianna had deserted her now. He stood for a minute, feeling unbearably awkward and out of place. With a terrible feeling that he was violating a privacy that ran deeper than anything he had ever known, but not knowing what else to do, he lifted the tiny metal circle to the light and read the words inside.
Da mi basi amile.
But it was Claire's voice that spoke the words, not his. Her voice